So much for size. But what do we know of the social structure and composition of the Khazar immigrant community? The first impression one gains is a striking similarity between certain privileged positions held by Khazar Jews in Hungary and in Poland in those early days. Both the Hungarian and Polish sources refer to Jews employed as mint masters, administrators of the royal revenue, controllers of the salt monopoly, tax collectors, and money lenders, that is, bankers. This parallel suggests a common origin of those two immigrant communities, and as we can trace the origins of the bulk of Hungarian Jewry to the Magyar-Khazar nexus, the conclusion seems self-evident. The early records reflect the part played by immigrant Jews in the two countries' budding economic life. That it was an important part is not surprising, since foreign trade and the levying of customs duties had been the Khazars' principal source of income in the past. They had the experience which their new hosts were lacking, and it was only logical that they were called in to advise and participate in the management of the finances of court and nobility. The coins, minted in the 12th and 13th centuries with Polish inscriptions in Hebrew lettering, are somewhat bizarre relics of these activities. The exact purpose they served is still something of a mystery. Some bear the name of a king, for example Leszek or Mieszko. Others are inscribed from the house of Abraham ben Joseph the Prince, possibly the minter banker himself, or show just a word of benediction, luck, or blessing. Significantly, contemporary Hungarian sources also speak of the practice of minting coins from silver provided by Jewish owners. However, in contrast to Western Europe, finance and commerce were far from being the only fields of Jewish activity. Some rich immigrants became landowners in Poland, as Count Teka was in Hungary. Jewish landholdings comprising a whole village of Jewish farmers are recorded, for instance, in the vicinity of Breslau before 1203, and in the early days there must have been Khazar peasants in considerable numbers, as the ancient Khazar place names seem to indicate. A tantalizing glimpse of how some of these villages may have come into being is provided by the Karaite records mentioned before. They relate how Prince Witold settled a group of Karaite prisoners of war in Krasna, providing them with houses, orchards, and land to a distance of 1.5 miles. Krasna has been tentatively identified with the Jewish small town Krasnoya in Podolia. But farming did not hold out a future for the Jewish community. There were several reasons for this. The rise of feudalism in the 14th century gradually transformed the peasants of Poland into serfs, forbidden to leave their villages, deprived of freedom of movement. At the same time, under the joint pressure of the ecclesiastic hierarchy and the feudal landlords, the Polish Parliament in 1496 forbade the acquisition of agricultural land by Jews. But the process of alienation from the soil must have started long before that. Apart from the specific causes just mentioned, religious discrimination, combined with the degradation of the free peasants into serfs, the transformation of the predominantly agricultural nation of Khazars into a predominantly urban community reflected a common phenomenon in the history of migrations. Faced with different climatic conditions and farming methods on the one hand, and on the other with unexpected opportunities for an easier living offered by urban civilization, immigrant populations are apt to change their occupational structure within a few generations. The offspring of Abruzzi peasants in the New World became waiters and restaurateurs. The grandsons of Polish farmers may become engineers or psychoanalysts. However, the transformation of Khazar Jewry into Polish Jewry did not entail any brutal break with the past or loss of identity. It was a gradual, organic process of change, which, as Poliak has convincingly shown, preserved some vital traditions of Khazar communal life in their new country. This was mainly achieved through the emergence of a social structure or way of life found nowhere else in the world diaspora. The Jewish small town, In Hebrew, ayara. In Yiddish, shtetl. In Polish, miasteczko. All three designations are diminutives, which, however, do not necessarily refer to smallness in size. Some were quite big small towns, but to the limited rights of municipal self-government they enjoyed. The shtetl should not be confused with the ghetto. The latter consisted of a street or quarter in which Jews were compelled to live within the confines of a Gentile town. It was, from the second half of the 16th century onward, the universal habitat of Jews everywhere in the Christian and most of the Muslim world. The ghetto was surrounded by walls, with gates that were locked at night. It gave rise to claustrophobia and mental inbreeding, but also to a sense of relative security in times of trouble. As it could not expand in size, the houses were tall and narrow-chested, and permanent overcrowding created deplorable sanitary conditions. It took great spiritual strength for people living in such circumstances to keep their self-respect. Not all of them did. The shtetl, on the other hand, was a quite different proposition, a type of settlement which, as already said, existed only in Poland-Lithuania and nowhere else in the world. It was a self-contained country town with an exclusively or predominantly Jewish population. The shtetl's origins probably date back to the 13th century and may represent the missing link, as it were, between the market towns of Khazaria and the Jewish settlements in Poland. The economic and social function of these semi-rural, semi-urban agglomerations seems to have been similar in both countries. In Khazaria, as later in Poland, they provided a network of trading posts or market towns which mediated between the needs of the big towns and the countryside. They had regular fairs at which sheep and cattle, alongside the goods manufactured in the towns and the products of the rural cottage industries, were sold or bartered. At the same time, they were the centers where artisans plied their crafts, from wheelwrights to blacksmiths, silversmiths, tailors, kosher butchers, millers, bakers, and candlestick makers. There were also letter writers for the illiterate, synagogues for the faithful, inns for travelers, and a heder, Hebrew for room, which served as a school. There were itinerant storytellers and folk bards, some of their names, such as Velvilsbarger, have been preserved, traveling from shtetl to shtetl in Poland, and no doubt earlier on in Khazaria, if one is to judge by the survival of storytellers among Oriental people to our day. Some particular trades became virtually a Jewish monopoly in Poland. One was dealing in timber, which reminds one that timber was the chief building material and an important export in Khazaria. Another was transport. "The dense net of shtetls," writes Poliak, quote, "made it possible to distribute manufactured goods over the whole country by means of the superbly built Jewish type of horse cart. The preponderance of this kind of transport, especially in the east of the country, was so marked, amounting to a virtual monopoly, that the Hebrew word for carter, Baal Agala, was incorporated into the Russian language as Balagula. Only the development of the railway in the second half of the 19th century led to a decline in this trade." End quote. Now, this specialization in coach building and cartering could certainly not have developed in the closed ghettos of Western Jewry. It unmistakably points to a Khazar origin. The people of the ghettos were sedentary, while the Khazars, like other semi-nomadic people, used horse or ox-drawn carts to transport their tents, goods, and chattel, including royal tents the size of a circus, fit to accommodate several hundred people. They certainly had the know-how to negotiate the roughest tracks in their new country. Other specifically Jewish occupations were innkeeping, the running of flour mills, and trading in furs, none of them found in the ghettos of Western Europe. Such, in broad outlines, was the structure of the Jewish shtetl in Poland. Some of its features could be found in old market towns in any country. Others show a more specific affinity with what we know, little though it is, about the townships of Khazaria, which were probably the prototypes of the Polish shtetl. To these specific features should be added the pagoda style of the oldest surviving wooden shtetl synagogues dating from the 15th and 16th centuries, which is totally different from both the native style of architecture and from the building style adopted by Western Jews and replicated later on in the ghettos of Poland. The interior decoration of the oldest shtetl synagogues is also quite different from the style of the Western ghetto. The walls of the shtetl synagogue were covered with Moorish arabesques and with animal figures characteristic of the Persian influence found in Magyar Khazar artifacts and in the decorative style brought to Poland by Armenian immigrants. The traditional garb of Polish Jewry is also of unmistakably Eastern origin. The typical long silk kaftan may have been an imitation of the coat worn by the Polish nobility, which itself was copied from the outfit of the Mongols in the Golden Horde. Fashions travel across political divisions. But we know that kaftans were worn long before that by the nomads of the steppes. The skullcap, yarmulke, is worn to this day by Orthodox Jews and by the Uzbeks and other Turkish people in the Soviet Union. On top of the skullcap, men wore the shtreimel, an elaborate round hat rimmed with fox fur, which the Khazars copied from the Kazakhs, or vice versa. As already mentioned, the trade in fox and sable furs, which had been flourishing in Khazaria, became another virtual Jewish monopoly in Poland. As for the women, they wore, until the middle of the 19th century, a tall white turban, which was an exact copy of the dzwoluk worn by Kazakh and Turkmen women. Nowadays, Orthodox Jewesses have to wear, instead of a turban, a wig made of their own hair, which is shaved off when they get married. One might also mention in this context, though somewhat dubiously, the Polish Jews' odd passion for gefilte, stuffed fish, a national dish which the Polish Gentiles adopted. Without fish, the saying went, there is no Sabbath. Was it derived from distant memories of life on the Caspian where fish was the staple diet? Life in the shtetl is celebrated with much romantic nostalgia in Jewish literature and folklore. Thus we read in a modern survey of its customs about the joyous way its inhabitants celebrated the Sabbath. Quote, wherever one is, he will try to reach home in time to greet the Sabbath with his own family. The peddler traveling from village to village, the itinerant tailor, shoemaker, cobbler, the merchant off on a trip, all will plan, push, hurry, trying to reach home before sunset on Friday evening. As they press homeward, the shamus calls through the streets of the shtetl, Jews to the bathhouse. A functionary of the synagogue, the shamus is a combination of sexton and beadle. He speaks with an authority more than his own, for when he calls Jews to the bathhouse, he is summoning them to a commandment. End quote. The most vivid evocation of life in the shtetl is the surrealistic amalgam of fact and fantasy in the paintings and lithographs of Marc Chagall, where biblical symbols appear side by side with the bearded carter wielding his whip and wistful rabbis in kaftan and yarmulke. It was a weird community, reflecting its weird origins. Some of the earliest small towns were probably founded by prisoners of war, such as the Karaites of Troki, whom Polish and Lithuanian nobles were anxious to settle on their empty lands. But the majority of these settlements were products of the general migration away from the wild fields, which were turning into deserts. After the Mongol conquest, wrote Poliak, when the Slav villages wandered westward, the Khazar shtetls went with them. The pioneers of the new settlements were probably rich Khazar traders who constantly traveled across Poland on the much-frequented trade routes into Hungary. Quote, the Magyar and Khabar migration into Hungary blazed the trail for the growing Khazar settlements in Poland. It turned Poland into a transit area between the two countries with Jewish communities. End quote. Thus, the traveling merchants were familiar with conditions in the prospective areas of resettlement, and had occasion to make contact with the landowners in search of tenants. Quote, "The landlord would enter into an agreement with such rich and respected Jews," we are reminded of Abraham Prokovnik, "as would settle on his estate and bring in other settlers. They would, as a rule, choose people from the place where they had lived." End quote. These colonists would be an assorted lot of farmers, artisans, and craftsmen, forming a more or less self-supporting community. Thus, the Khazar shtetl would be transplanted and become a Polish shtetl. Farming would gradually drop out, but by that time, the adaptation to changed conditions would have been completed. The nucleus of modern Jewry thus followed the old recipe: strike out for new horizons, but stick together.